Dr. Press?
Take a break.
Okay, be back in 15 minutes, and we'll start with agenda item 15. Okay, are we ready to resume our meeting? Ms. Oaken?
Wait.
Wait.
We'll say Mr. Briggs first.
Mr. Briggs first.
Our next item is item 15.
Okay.
Actually, I do have a little stage setting to do.
Chairman Young, he comes back from 6 months, and then he wants protocol?
Yeah, really. No, I do want to set the stage a little bit because I want to talk about the context of what Lori's going to be talking about in the bigger picture of not only what we're doing as a region, but also what we're going to be talking about at our next couple of meetings. So, as you know, we've been trying to crystallize our vision for the region, and what we have thus far is the idea of a region made up of healthy functioning watersheds, and that is a watershed that's actually porous, that isn't completely paved over. A porous watershed retains a significant amount of rainfall. If we change the land uses in a manner that seals off the surface of the watershed, then we turn our watersheds from a functioning sponge that can hold some water and provide base flow for our creeks to the equivalent of a concrete-lined river. Not a good thing. Low-impact development is a method of land use change that retains the land's natural sponge-like properties so that they have a chance of being a healthy, functioning watershed. Our stormwater program is really our strongest and our best opportunity to further low-impact development efforts. So, one of the things I want to point out to you in terms of the context of what Lori's going to be talking about is that in July, we plan a workshop on our stormwater program. Some of the stuff that we'll be discussing at that time would be how we review our stormwater management plans that we receive from entities, what our exchanges are with the stormwater entities and the review of those plans, how we analyze changes to those swamps, how we evaluate if the collection of best management practices that makes up the stormwater management plan meets the maximum extent practicable standard. And more specifically, we intend to cover, number one, the regulations intent, number two, stormwater management plan development and our staff review and process, review process and the timeline for that, number three, monitoring within stormwater management program. We expect to also provide information for the board on our review of the agencies, the individual agencies' monitoring and reporting component, that is the things like the agency's inspection frequency, how they follow up on problems that they find in those inspections, what's the feedback to ensure that those problems are corrected, how do we ensure that priority pollutants for the area that's covered by the stormwater management plan are addressed in that swamp. And we hope to provide all that information and have a discussion, an interchange, and a workshop setting with the board at our July board meeting.
Which is going to be up north?
Right, in Watsonville.
Okay.
So I want you to know that that is our intent, to cover all those aspects of the stormwater program in July. Today, Lori Oaken, our counsel, is basically responding to a request by the board to her to volunteer to provide a presentation on institutionalizing low-impact development and how we can do a better job of standardizing our stormwater requirements. So I hope that helps set the stage a little bit, and I'll turn it over to Lori.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board.
Good morning.
As Mr. Briggs said, I am your counsel du jour, since you had different counsel yesterday. It occurred to me this morning that during the course of this meeting, I've been in the audience upstairs watching you on the webcast, on the dais, and here, and so far I like it best up there. The chair asked me to talk about a couple different things having to do with low-impact development. What tools does the board have to require low-impact development? What procedural requirements apply to implementing each of these tools? How much specificity the board can require? How to change the public perception of low-impact development as an expensive burden to seeing it as a social, economic, and environmental benefit, and how to encourage low-impact development and remove obstacles to its implementation. In considering this, I think the board needs to keep in mind that low-impact development isn't a goal in and of itself. It's a means to achieving the goal of healthy functioning watersheds, so it's important not to consider LID in isolation from other tools that the board has. And finally, having a legal discussion before there's a staff technical proposal is a little bit backwards from the way we usually do things. Usually, staff looks at what they think will work on the ground, and then we develop the most appropriate legal mechanism to achieve that. So I'm talking in somewhat of a vacuum, but I think this is a good way to set the stage both for the July presentation and some other things that staff is working on that Jennifer Bidding will talk about after my presentation. So what is LID? Mr. Briggs addressed this briefly, but this is a definition that's evolving. It's an evolving science, and there's different definitions, but it's generally considered to be construction design features that reduce runoff flow rate, volume, and to a lesser extent, duration, which in turn reduces pollutant loads and adverse environmental effects downstream. The goal is to preserve pre-development hydrology, including natural site features such as riparian corridors and wetlands and tree canopy. There's a couple approaches to increasing the specificity of LID requirements and imposing more LID requirements. The first is to specify design standards and construction specifications that require particular features to be installed, such as a sediment basin has to be constructed and it has to have particular dimensions. A second approach is to look more at the healthy functioning watershed goal and to consider what receiving water standards are required and what flow limits and narrative and numeric objectives are necessary to protect that, and that in turn will drive low impact development in order to meet those requirements. And, of course, those two approaches aren't mutually exclusive. And, in fact, they're virtually always used in tandem in permitting. The four primary regulatory tools the board has at its disposal are the Municipal Stormwater Program, the Construction Stormwater Program, and the 401 certification, basin planning, and what I'm calling optional resources, which are things like grants, providing templates and educational materials, staff outreach, and that sort of thing. The first and most powerful tool at the board's disposal at this time is the Municipal Stormwater Permitting Program, or the MS4 program. One of the requirements for a stormwater management plan, which is a component of the MS4 permit, is to address post-construction hydrology and runoff. The stormwater management plan must reduce pollutants to the maximum extent practicable. And one of the ways that the swamps do that in the post-construction goal is to include a post-construction ordinance. So that's an important way to remove existing obstacles for permitted entities, because one of the problems that we've had reported is that there are ordinances that either prevent implementation of LID or conflict with some of these requirements. So when the permittees develop their mandatory stormwater ordinances, they need to review all existing procedures, planning guidelines, general plan provisions to make sure they don't impede the development of the swamp requirements. So basically, the MEP standard establishes the level of pollutant reductions that dischargers must achieve. It's a technology-based standard, and in order to reduce pollutant loads, we found that reducing flow, volume, and duration of runoff is necessary, which fits in very nicely with the definition of low-impact development. They're very similar if you compare these. And, in fact, in the federal regulations for the stormwater program, the EPA guidance says that maintaining pre-development runoff conditions is one of the specific purposes of the post-construction goal. So, clearly, LID is an integral part of developing stormwater management. In terms of standardizing LID requirements and the way it's implemented throughout the region, one option is to adopt a region-wide general MS4 permit or do watershed-based sub-regional permits. today we're talking about LID, but obviously if the board were to adopt a region-wide permit, it wouldn't just include LID. It would cover the whole gamut of what's included in the permitting requirements. General permits are a good way to increase specificity. The permits can be pretty specific in terms of minimum BMPs, performance standards, narrative or numeric receiving water limits. Theoretically, the permits can include numeric effluent limits, although the State Board recently commissioned a blue ribbon panel to study the feasibility of numeric effluent limits in municipal permits, and the panel concluded that they weren't feasible at this time. The one thing to keep in mind is that the more specific a permit gets, the more you have to consider Water Code Section 13360, which prohibits the board from specifying the design, location, or manner of compliance with its requirements. So if you have something like a performance standard where the board determines in order to meet the MEP standard, you have to retain a certain volume of stormwater on site for a certain period of time, that doesn't run afoul of Section 13360. But as the BMPs get more specific, the dischargers have to have an opportunity to propose alternative BMPs that are more suitable to their goals or their locality, as long as the substitute BMPs achieve the same efficacy within an equivalent period of time. Other things that could be included are checklists of things that have to be included in a stormwater management plan, or weighted scoring tools or decision tools on if you have certain site conditions, what types of features need to be installed. Having a regional permit is not a prerequisite for having a regional monitoring plan. This is an issue that comes up every time the board considers a stormwater management plan. What type of monitoring should we require? Who should do it? How should it be done? The board has authority independent of the permits to require discharges to monitor their discharges. So whether or not there's a regional permit, the board could adopt a regional monitoring order that applied not just to municipalities that already have enrollment in the permit, but to municipalities who have their plans pending review, and to smaller municipalities who aren't subject to the permitting requirements, because those municipalities are still discharging stormwater, so the board still has authority to regulate them. They just aren't required to get NPDES permits for their systems.
Lori, how would that work, though? I mean, you're saying we could require monitoring of an entity that doesn't have a permit?
Yes. We do it all the time for cleanups. It's the same authority that allows us to require dischargers doing cleanups to do investigation, or dischargers who are suspected of having discharged. We use that authority if we need more information before writing a permit. And in terms of a regional program, it's something, if this is a direction that the board ends up going, one thing to consider is integrating it with CCAMP and CLEAN and other ongoing monitoring efforts throughout the region. But the CLEAN program is a potential model, as is the monitoring program that was developed under the ag waiver. In terms of timing considerations, the procedures for developing our own permit would be that staff develops a draft permit, provides for notice and comment, the board holds a public hearing, and then approves a permit. The permit takes effect at that point, and of course it's subject to a State Water Board petition and subsequent legal action. Staff estimates that because of the scope that regional permits would have to address, it would take 2 years from the beginning of the project to get a permit before the board for consideration. In the meantime, as Dr. Wolf mentioned earlier, the State Board is planning to reissue the statewide general permit next year. So if a regional permit is a direction the board is interested in looking at, I think it's important that, first of all, of course, the regional board staff not be working at cross purposes with the State Board staff, who is on a similar track at the same time, but that they not duplicate their efforts, because it may well be that the permit the State Board is developing meets all the regional board's goals for standardization and requirements for low-impact development. One issue that may come up is that our municipalities have been developing their stormwater plans since 2003, And many of them, even the ones whose swamps haven't been approved, have invested substantial time and money in developing those programs. And all or parts of those programs may be very good, so I think it's important in developing this kind of regional planning not to undo the good work that's already been done. The final issue is what procedure applies for approving notices of intent to seek coverage under the permit. As you know, under the current permitting regime, any time a member of the public requests a hearing on a stormwater management plan, the board holds a hearing and considers public comment. And before permit coverage takes effect, even if there's no request for a public hearing, regional board staff has to review the stormwater plan and approve it before permit coverage takes effect. If there was a permit that had more specific requirements in it, it is likely that that kind of individual review wouldn't be necessary for all the swamps. That's the approach that the state board has taken in the preliminary draft of the construction permit. They made it much more specific than the last permit by including action levels, some numeric effluent limits, more detailed BMPs, and a stormwater pollution prevention plan that just demonstrates compliance with the requirements of the permit as opposed to developing a lot of the requirements. And the state board's position is that meets all the requirements for public participation and review when the state board adopts the general permit. The draft gives the public the ability to request that a regional board review a permit in more detail and hold a hearing, but it doesn't require that the regional board do that before permit coverage takes effect. I agree with the state board's analysis that public participation process is adequate under the Clean Water Act, but there have already been some comments submitted from the ones I've seen are from California Coast Keeper Alliance and Santa Monica Bay Keeper, arguing that this new procedure does not comply with the public participation and review requirements. So it could ultimately be the case as the law develops in this area that even if there's a regional stormwater permit, the board would still have to review the notices of intent as they come in. Although the MS4 program is a very powerful tool for implementing low-impact development, it doesn't cover everything. The Phase 2 regulations don't require stormwater management plans to address construction on less than 1 acre, although nationwide many Phase 2 swamps do include smaller sites, and in fact the State Board's permit does include smaller sites in the Attachment 4 requirements that apply to rapidly growing and larger municipalities. The permitting requirements also don't apply to non-urban areas, which oftentimes are the most rapidly developing areas where you want LID requirements in place before it's too late. Projects that are greater than 1 acre in size or that the board designates as a significant contributor of pollutants to surface waters still need to get a construction permit if they're in a non-urban area, but there's no comprehensive municipal program in those areas. One question is how much construction there is that's under 1 acre. When EPA adopted the regulations, they had done some research and concluded that nationwide only 2.5% by acreage of sites were less than 1 acre, and that's why those sites were excluded from the regulation. But there has been, I'm not aware of any statistics in this region, how many small sites there are and what their impacts are. Obviously, a small site on a hill slope above a creek is going to be more significant than a small site in an isolated area. The second tool is the Construction Permitting Program and Clean Water Act Section 401 certifications. I think Dr. Wolf covered this pretty well. I just did want to mention that the HydroMod requirements in the new draft require all sites to have post-development runoff volume approximate pre-development volume. For larger sites, there are additional requirements to preserve drainage channels and preserve time of concentration on site.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
There's some in areas where development is going in on top of ag land, you could conceivably have the pre-construction runoff higher than even non-LID construction. So if they're required to maintain pre-construction runoff, then they're going to have to add water to their runoff. Has that been dealt with at all?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Are you writing this down? In terms of what the region can do in standardizing and implementing LID, it doesn't make any sense at this stage of the state board's development to look into regional construction permits. If there are very large or significant sites for which the current permit is inadequate, the board always has the ability to write a site-specific permit for a large development. 401 certifications are required when the federal government is issuing a permit for dredging and filling, which is also often part of large construction projects. Under the 401 program, the board can regulate the activity as a whole and impose any requirements necessary to assure compliance with appropriate state laws. So it's actually a little bit broader in scope than some of our other permitting programs. This is a tool that's traditionally been underutilized throughout the state, but I think we're starting to look more at how we can use the 401 program to make sure that the program as a whole, the whole construction project as opposed to just the bulldozing the creek, protects the watershed. The procedural requirements for adopting a region-wide permit would be the same as for adopting a regional MS4 permit, and the same issue would arise for approval of the notices of intent. I put WDRs and conditional waivers on here. That's an avenue that the board has available in areas that aren't covered by the construction permitting requirements. CEQA, if the board were to use those tools, CEQA would apply. CEQA does not apply to NPDES permits. But generally, in any situation where the board would be using its Port of Cologne authority to regulate this type of discharge, it's virtually certain that a local entity would have done an EIR, so CEQA isn't that much of a concern from our perspective. 401 certifications are a much shorter process and more streamlined process than the permitting process. 401 certs are usually approved at the staff level, although they could certainly be taken before the board and sometimes are in larger controversial projects. And CEQA also applies to the 401 cert process.
And Lori, how do you harmonize, or is there any reconciliation that needs to take place between having a regional permit and a state permit? Would a regional permit supersede a
Yes.
statewide permit?
Yes, if that's the way the permit was written. I mean, there could be a permit that only applied to municipalities of a certain size, or we could decide there's a particularly sensitive watershed where the board wants to do a regional permit and just have a permit for that area. But generally, all the state board general permits give the regional board the authority to issue site-specific permits or region-wide permits if it's more appropriate.
Well, wouldn't the state board permit supersede if it had areas that were more stringent?
Our permit would have to include provisions that were at least as stringent as the state permit, okay, unless there was some site-specific reason not to do that. The next tool is basin planning. The benefits of basin planning is that it looks at the whole picture of the region and of the sub-watershed, so it provides a comprehensive approach. It can be used to provide clearer standards for permittees, and for discharges that we don't have authority over or municipalities that we're not regulating, it provides a policy statement and sometimes important CEQA guidance for local plan reviews. There's a lot that can be done within the basin plan. The first option is to review the beneficial uses. There's two components of that. One is to make sure the existing beneficial uses that are already defined in the basin plan are applied appropriately to the watersheds throughout the region so that all of our watersheds have all the designations to support the existing uses. The board has to support existing uses, whether they're designated in the basin plan or not, support and protect them. But I think it's a more powerful tool and more clear if the uses are adequately designated. The second thing to look at is whether new beneficial uses should be defined, and this is something that's starting to happen throughout the state in consideration of riparian corridor policies. For example, one of the new uses that's being considered, which is already included in one basin plan, I think, is a water quality enhancement beneficial use to recognize the protective qualities a wetland has with relation to adjacent water bodies, to protect that water quality enhancement use separately from the main stem that the wetlands is protecting. Once the beneficial uses are in place, you move on to water quality objectives, and review could be done to ensure that we have all the water quality objectives defined in the basin plan that we need to protect the beneficial uses, particularly in the areas of protecting the healthy functioning watersheds. The basin plan includes an anti-degradation policy, and there's a state and federal anti-degradation policy. Basically, for water bodies that are not impaired, this is an anti-degradation policy. It's not a non-degradation policy. So if appropriate findings are made and best practicable treatment and control is applied, receiving waters can be degraded without violating the policy as long as they're not degraded below applicable water quality standards. There's been some discussion recently about what's known as Tier 2.5. Under the federal anti-deg rule, there's Tier 1, 2, and 3. Tier 3 are outstanding national resource waters where new discharges are completely prohibited. Tier 2 is most waters that are meeting water quality objectives. Tier 2.5 would be a higher level of anti-degradation requirement, so that sensitive or particularly valuable water bodies would have to meet more stringent requirements in order to receive new discharges. The implementation plan can do a lot of what can be done in permits, and in addition, the board can impose conditional prohibitions. For example, the board could prohibit any new discharges from construction in particular areas unless there was an approved low-impact development plan. The board itself doesn't have to approve the plan. You could do a prohibition that says approved by a local entity. This is an approach that we've taken in some recent TMDLs with the grazing program. And then finally, TMDLs, it's not really a basin planning option. It's a basin planning requirement. These only apply to impaired waters, but each of the TMDLs must have an implementation plan, and a lot of our implementation plans do impose requirements on municipalities for their stormwater programs. The biggest drawback with the basin planning process is that it's a very long process and it's difficult to change. I left all these requirements up here just to demonstrate how long the process is. There are fairly rigorous CEQA requirements in that the board has to consider the feasible means to comply with any basin plan requirements, potential impacts of those means to compliance, and mitigations for the impacts and alternatives to the means to compliance. So some of the recent CEQA documents that have been released throughout the state are fairly extensive. There's four agencies that need to approve a basin plan amendment, so it does take quite a bit of time before the basin plan amendment becomes final. And the basin plan is very inflexible, so as the science of low-impact development evolves, if the board wants to change anything that it put in the basin plan, you get to start all over. The final thing on basin planning is that basin plan requirements, other than prohibitions, aren't self-effectuating. So we establish beneficial uses, we establish water quality objectives, but we can't directly enforce them until we issue a permit to implement those requirements, except for prohibitions, which are directly enforceable. The final tool are these optional resources, and I don't have a lot to say about that. I think staff will be addressing these quite a bit in the next few months. I'm going to turn it... not quite yet. In terms of next steps, as I think has been pretty clear, the most powerful tool that the board has at its disposal at this point is the Municipal Stormwater Program. Staff actually has been doing quite a bit to require and implement LID through this program, and they're going to be telling you about that in the next few months. And now I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Bidding, who's going to talk a little bit more specifically about what staff is working on.
Thank you. One thing that's exciting about working on low-impact development right now is the fact that there are so many other people that are excited about working on low-impact development right now, including yourselves and lots of municipalities, as well as all sorts of nonprofits and academic institutions and even developers. There's really a lot of excitement moving in the direction of low-impact development right now. And so I wanted to sort of capture a little bit about what we've done in the past, what we're working on presently, and what we plan to do in the future concerning low-impact development, so that you can sort of recap on what we've done in the past as well as see where we're going. As you'll recall, we have given some water quality awards in the past for low-impact development, such as the Manzanita Housing Project at UCSB. We've also put on workshops and given presentations at all sorts of professional organizations, meetings, and things like that. And so now we're moving into a phase of grants where we're actually giving money away for projects to be implemented on the ground, as well as design standards, plans, and all sorts of other supporting things required to actually make low-impact development a reality. So then there's also some things that have been ongoing, and we think that these things will continue to be ongoing, such as CEQA reviews and finding ways to make low-impact development a part of the CEQA review process and commenting in that manner. Also, putting low-impact development into stormwater management plans as much as we can using the regulatory tools that we have available to us right now. And then one thing that we've been doing is requiring source control, such as LID, as a first consideration. So writing letters to municipalities, basically pushing them as far as we can in the encouragement type direction to implement low impact development. So where we plan to take this next is in the creation of a regulatory tool. And so I wanted to sort of just talk about that a little bit, because I know that there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm surrounding this, and Lori's just given us a great rundown of all the options from the legal perspective, and I wanted to fill you in on, from the technical perspective, what our perspective is in choosing these options. So some of the questions we want to consider is what has been done in other places, and most importantly, why. So I'm looking into right now what's been done in other regions as well as other states, and that information is easy to find. The really exciting information, though, the icing on the cake, is the why. So why have certain things been implemented in other places, and that gives us an idea as to whether or not they would work here. It also gives us an idea as to whether or not they were political decisions or technical decisions, which allows us to make better decisions about what we would like to recommend be implemented here. And then, of course, did it work, which is a really important question. A lot of things have been tried that have not worked as well, and there have been a lot of admissions of this from other regional boards and other states, things that were sort of a first-generation try, and so there's been a lot of lessons learned. So we want to take advantage of that knowledge as much as possible as we choose where we want to go. And then, so the why or why not? Why or why didn't it work? There's been some municipalities, for example, that had phase one permits that have benefited from a first, second, and now third generation try at pollutant reduction and volume reduction. So that gives us a lot to go on as to what's working and what's not. And then also we need to define terms. There's a lot of terms being used, things like bioswales, things like low-impact development. These words are being used and sometimes not used consistently, and we need to define terms. And an example of a term that we need to define is one actually that Mr. Shawcross brought up concerning post-development versus pre-development. Do we want to use those terms, or are those confusing? Should we say just the natural state, or should we call it pre-development? So I think in choosing some of the words that we want to use will help us actually have what we want to have implemented and be able to enforce it down the road. And so also defining terms such as imperviousness and things like that, things that we think that we have a common understanding of, but actually you can sort of weasel your way around these things if we don't have clear definitions of what we mean by them. And then, of course, how much? So it's really easy to say that we want a volume reduction and pollutant load reduction, but the question is how much? And when we say to the MEP, how much is that? And so in areas where we have TMDLs, that makes it a little bit easier, but in areas where we don't, we need to determine what sorts of pollutants are the concern there and how much do they need to be reduced by. And then, of course, probably the most important question is, will it result in a long-term environmental protection or enhancement? So the mechanism that we choose to implement in our region, will it actually gain us the thing that we're looking for as a long-term solution? So those are just sort of a brief rundown of the things that we're considering.
You might add something to that list,
sure.
Mr. Wolf kind of alluded to, and perhaps it's something, it's not water quality, but it's a benefit that maybe we could be keeping track of, and that is there an increase in property value? Mm-hmm. Does it result in less maintenance costs? Mm-hmm. Does it increase water supply? You know, things like that might be helpful.
Yeah, those are definitely things that low-impact development does, as well as other tools. But I was sort of speaking of our regulatory mechanism.
I understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Question. on your point about what does it get us in the future? We develop regulatory approaches to deal with a particular hydrologic regime in a particular climate. We've got climate change. Maybe we're starting a drought. I hope not, but this could be the beginning of a very different decade, maybe a different set of decades. So what you come up with and what we've developed for the usual regime may be very different. What if you depend on a certain amount of rainfall to keep your vegetation, you know, there, and it doesn't happen, it doesn't come. So this is part of a general category of policies that that I call the make the deal and go home policies, where you get agreement to implement something, a BMP, acquire a piece of land, put in the low impact development, and then you have a party. Everybody goes home, and there isn't really much thought or requirement of performance in the future. You talk about performance standards, getting those performance standards, and actually trying to fashion regulatory tools that require that you actually pay. Or that there will be ongoing interventions in the future is something that we're not as good at, and that would be good to address as well.
That actually is addressed in the draft construction permit. It does require that the developer demonstrate before beginning construction that there's a long-term maintenance plan in effect, either that there's an agreement that a municipality will take over the maintenance or that it's funded long-term. It's also generally a requirement in the stormwater management plans as part of the post-construction ordinance, and the management plans that I've reviewed, I've made sure that that was included, because it doesn't work without that.
Right, and I guess I'd like to think of these things as a sort of a permanent partnership, a reopener. You always come back. It'd be unrealistic to think that you just do something one way once and it'll be good forever. Nothing's like that. Nothing human is like that. So, anyway, I like to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely intend that whatever I end up recommending as a regulatory tool will have flexibility, because we know that low-impact development technology is changing constantly, and it isn't the type of thing where we can decide on one particular thing, call it fantastic, throw a party, and go home. It is going to be something that we're going to need to revisit to make sure that it is being implemented, to make sure that it is working, and then to make sure that it's getting us the result that we were looking for.
Well, you know, what's your sense of the capacity of the construction and landscaping industry to implement these approaches? It used to be that if you wanted to do this, you had to get that long-haired environmental studies alum, you know, wearing a tie-dye T-shirt and, you know, coming up with their PEDEX. And that'd be the only person in our 200-mile radius who would even consider doing it. So what if you want this to take off? How is the industry going to respond, and how are they going to beef up their capacity?
That's a great question, and actually the answer is multifaceted because, as I said, there's tons of excitement surrounding this. I think that, I'm not quite sure why, but I would speculate that perhaps people are realizing that not only does it work, but it's something that everyone can sort of feel good about, as opposed to the type of solution, stormwater pollution solution, where you have to manufacture it and then put it in the ground and then take it out and put it in the landfill. It's a lot easier to feel better about a bioswale that you are just mowing and landscaping as you normally would. You can compost the clippings. You know, I mean, I think in general, it's actually really quite surprising to see all the different levels at which people are starting to understand the concept and become familiar and aware. So, as you mentioned, if you take into consideration the landscaper that can understand how to maintain these types of things, even the engineer that can understand how to design it, the municipalities that can understand how to require it and how to check for it and look for it, make sure it's implemented and enforced. I think at all levels we're seeing all sorts of awareness, which is great. There is definitely a need still for a continuing growing intellectual infrastructure so that we can get the best information out to everyone. And I think that's something that we are working on as well, trying to figure out how we can create some sort of low-impact development institute or something like that that could get the information out, because that's definitely needed. And at our capacity here within this agency, we're not going to be able to be all things to all people. So we're going to need to build that infrastructure into place as well.
Yes, Dada, come on up to the podium.
Hi, I'm Donette Dunaway. I wanted to give you an answer that over the last year at least, I went to engineering groups and architecture groups and other professional groups and presented what low-impact development is and what the purpose of it is. And what I found after about a year's worth of going out to people is that the response was overwhelmingly, it makes sense, we can do it. The only reason that we're not doing it is because it's not required. So I took that back and thought about it and talked to our group about it, and you know, we're moving on with that, and hence Jennifer's work. And then now we have two grants for low-impact development, and so we've got some engineers and some landscape architects that are now faced with, here's the money, what we want is LID, can you make it happen? And they're having to struggle, and they're having to learn, and they're doing it. And we met with one group yesterday and another group the day before, two different engineering groups, and it is fantastic because they are able to figure out how to get around the constraints. Both of these are retrofits, so they have physical constraints. They also have high groundwater in one case, clay soils in another case, all kinds of constraints, and they're working it out. They're figuring it out. So it is doable, and it's very, very exciting. So that I wanted to report that back. Very exciting.
Where do we have any LID projects right now, pilot projects that are underway?
Actually, I neglected to even say we have more than two. One is up in Santa Margarita, and it's a grant that was awarded to the county of San Luis Obispo, and they are doing what they've got is Santa Margarita is essentially built in the floodplain. So there's these flooding issues. So they are enhancing a wetland upstream of the town to capture, detain, and it will treat the stormwater before releasing it. And then downstream at the lower end of the town, they're putting in bioswales along the streets to carry that water through, again, slow it down, do some treatment, as well as have a little bit of infiltration, not very much, because they've got very high groundwater. So Santa Margarita is one, and Templeton is the other. That's also a retrofit bioswale-type project where they are removing pavement, they're putting in a bioswale, they're putting in pervious pavement, and they're working on different types of pervious pavers and concrete and so on, so that they can see what the pros and cons of each of them are. Then we also have up in the city of Salinas three projects that are their box store type projects, and the city has required them to send all of the runoff that comes from the roof and the parking lots through infiltration galleries, I'll call them, and they're not quite bioswales, but they are acting as bioswales before releasing the water into the storm drain system. So all three of these projects are taking LID approaches that are out of the handbooks, and they're having to modify them to make it work for their areas, and they're doing it. So in all those places. It's really great.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Shallcross.
Yeah, with my Carl Lake hat on, I met with the developers for the first phase of the Salinas build-out, and they went back and redesigned their whole project to implement LID because the city required them to. And it's really a fantastic project just to see what they've done. You know, creating pervious services, detention ponds, retention ponds, and really create, there's a creek that goes through the project, and really making that a major part of it, huge buffers, and it was pretty neat. I mean, I went in there, you know, sort of dreading what I was going to see, but it was pretty exciting stuff. And, you know, that was something that, you know, we actually had an impact on making that happen. And the engineering folks who actually designed it were a very sophisticated group of folks. I don't know if you guys have worked with them, but it was really encouraging to see folks at that high level. Getting all these ideas and actually being able to come up with some good designs. So
we should be probably just keeping in mind that we want to be acknowledging, you know, as more of this starts to happen, acknowledging these efforts in the region in some fashion, you know. Yes. Mr. Wolf.
Whenever it's a friendly thing, call me Gary. And if you're really upset with me, call me Dr. Wolf.
Okay.
Some of the questions were excellent, and I just thought it was incumbent upon me to share a little bit of what I know with respect to two questions.
Okay.
The one was the question about maintenance. This is a key issue and is related to the distinction I was mentioning earlier, where some boards feel as if controlling hydromodification on site, which is the approach that's being used in the general construction permit as well, is important, while other boards, especially the Santa Ana board, have been more comfortable with sort of regional solutions, that you can modify the flow, the runoff from a particular site, but if you catch it downstream and percolate it or manage it in some way, that's okay. And one of the big differences in those opinions is whether the maintenance for regional or sub-watershed level facilities will be adequate or not. If you have adequate maintenance, then those facilities tend to work well. If you build them and then they get neglected, you're in trouble. San Diego region's been very concerned. I guess they've been burned a few times by things that were built and weren't maintained. In Santa Ana region, they've had, because it's a smaller region, a little more cohesive in terms of the developer community, especially involving a couple of very big development companies like the Irvine Company, it's been easier for them to make arrangements for homeowners associations or other mechanisms to exist where there's good maintenance of those facilities. Through the what are they called, the conditions and covenants, CC&Rs of the development. So the maintenance issue is related to this issue I mentioned earlier, and I just wanted to point that out. And second, with respect to your question, if I'm angry at you, I'll call you Chair Young, but I'll call you Jeffrey. With respect to your question about economics, that's a critically important question with regard to the choice of means you use that Lori went through. If you're using Clean Water Act permitting, then the economics are not especially relevant. The law requires something, and you do it. If you're using basin plan amendments or WDRs under basin plan amendments, and if you're going to amend the plan to have receiving water objectives, which is what Regions 1 and 2 are talking about doing in their stream and wetland policy, which they're about 2 years down the road in that process, Then you need to go through Section 13241 of the Water Code, which says when you adopt those new objectives, you consider a list of factors, and one of those factors is economic considerations. So all of those issues of economic benefits become critical if you go down that mechanism pathway as opposed to the Clean Water Act pathway.
Mm. Say, Gary, I've talked to Tam about this in terms of having the State Board do something more with LID to institutionalize it.
Yeah.
And I haven't as yet received much of a maybe the response I would feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping maybe as the general swamp gets renewed that, you know, hopefully our staff will maybe be participating in that and providing some suggestions on how to take LID and implement it statewide.
Yeah.
Which would maybe do away with our need to have to go with a regional permit. So I would hope you'll
agree and support that. I hope that comes through in the strategic plan meetings. Be sure to send, if you can, send that up as one of the top regional priorities as a part of your discussion about how the strategic plan, because I would like to see that to be one of the top statewide priorities.
Okay.
Is how to address hydro modification in a comprehensive, sensible, rational way. Personally, I think the state is going to go to 80 to 100 million people eventually. We don't talk about that. We talk about 50 million by 2030. But if you look at worldwide population projections, we're talking maybe 12 to 14 billion before stabilization, which means maybe 80 to 100 million for California. And that means that the way we develop is critically important to the future quality of life. It's a very high-level strategic issue for me, and the more we hear that coming out of the regions, the more it's going to help us to get that into our planning and to get some push around that at
the
state
board. And that's critical. The sooner we start to do it, the easier it'll be and the less costly.
I agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Great. So we'll keep you plugged in to
our
efforts with this.
Yes. And I think Tam is personally supportive, but she just has only so much bandwidth for so many things.
And I appreciate that. It's not really a criticism. She has a lot more to deal with.
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, we pick out, and for our region, we're at least the board wants to focus on that. But that should benefit the state, because if we really hone in on this and develop something like we did with the Ag Waiver Program, there should be some overflow benefit.
Absolutely. And there's a pooling of resources, as I said. You know, some of the regions have been very interested in this, have held workshops. There's regional staff who are very knowledgeable, and others are less knowledgeable, and we're not getting maximum benefit of sharing that information yet. But we're going to get there.
Good. Okay. Yes, Mr. Jeffries.
Yeah, a couple comments. As long as you can prove to developers that it's cost efficient for them to go that direction, they'll go that direction very happily.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Wolf, I know you mentioned CCNRs. CCNRs aren't worth the paper they're written on in some cases. Let me just explain why, because I've got personal experience with those. Unless there's some mechanism that you can either make the local municipalities or counties accountable for those CCNRs, they're just written on a piece of paper. There's nobody to enforce them. The other issue that I have, and I've mentioned this before as we've talked about this project, and I support it wholeheartedly, because I think it's an opportunity for us to capture a lot of water which would be necessary that could be percolated, but also to stop some of the stormwater constituents getting into our waterways. It's also important that the people that maintain these facilities understand how to maintain them, because a lot of people out there don't know how to do that. And the other concern I've expressed is that, especially in residential areas, you have the common homeowner that doesn't understand why this was put in, and so consequently they don't think it's good, so they start to change. Now, it may be only be a small percentage, but you have a small percentage here and a small percentage there, and pretty soon it changes the whole outlook of what we're trying to do and in the attempt of the whole project. So I would rather, if we could work some other method of other than CCNRs, because most projects will have, you know, the city councils will say, or the staff will say, oh, we got CCRs, to regulate that. But there is no body that regulates the CC&Rs. It's a self-governing within that particular project. Now, we have a lot of projects, and the staff's well aware of Salinas is a big one coming up in this area, and all the way down the Salinas Valley. City of Greenfield's attempting to annex 1,000 acres, Soledad, a couple thousand acres, Gonzales, 1,500 acres. So there are a lot of residential units, and I would like to see to all of this to go in this type of project.
Right.
But again, if we do all this, and it's all put in, and if it's not taken care of properly, and there's, and I don't like more laws, but if we don't make it some kind of regulation that it's maintained that way, we'll lose it all.
You're absolutely right, and I'm trying to remember details and not quite able to dredge them up, but I toured Irvine Ranch and met with some of the people involved with some of the innovative things they've done, including Gary Brown, who is the Orange County Coast Keeper, and the keepers often tend to be on the opposite end of the spectrum from developers, but in this case, they've worked very well together, and they did something more recently where they, I think Orange County sort of backstopped or in some way guaranteed the CC&Rs or took them under county, you know, requirements. I can't remember the details of it, but you're absolutely right. The CC&Rs alone were not considered adequate, and the county through the stormwater program became involved, and they worked out a complicated set of legal agreements that, you know, to make it work. And so I agree with what you're saying, and it also provides another example, though, of where an inconsistency between regions can be frustrating, because Orange County and the Irvine Ranch straddle two regions, Santa Ana and San Diego, and after they work out this complicated thing for a development that's in the Santa Ana region and get an approval there and do it, they then turn to replicate it in the San Diego area, and apparently they were told by that board, no, that won't work. So it was very frustrating because it was a very convoluted process to get a suitable solution. When they finally got there, you know, they couldn't use it. They couldn't replicate it in another region. So I do understand your concern about CC&Rs, and I wish I could remember the details of that, and we could probably dredge it up and provide it to you.
Well, maintenance districts are a much better tool than CC&Rs.
Okay.
And because then they set up a financial trail that they have the dollars to do the maintenance. Because the first thing to go in a city when they start running short is they start cutting back on the maintenance, whether it's streets, sidewalks, or whatever, because they continue to have to fund police and fire, which is understandable. But that saying that, that still does not give them the right to neglect that type of maintenance to keep that up. And you see that in every city, is that, you know, the financial situation that we've just gone through in the last 4 or 5 years, where the cities have, and the counties and special districts have been shorted financially to make up the state budget. These maintenance features seem to go by the way of the just go by.
Well, can you, within the maintenance district concept, can you lock in the revenue so it can't be used for some other purpose? So it's dedicated revenue on the property tax bill for that purpose.
That's right. It has to stay within, and only that money can only be used in that district, unless the city's got a way to manipulate that. But the law is pretty firm on if it's collected for that use, then it has to be used for that use.
Okay. The staff still has more, right?
Just a little bit. I'm going to turn it over to Chris Adair, who's going to talk a little bit about the July workshop. But before I do that, I just wanted to point out that we have stormwater staff today that are participating in this, but the basin planning staff is also active on these issues, and Chris Rose of the basin planning staff has been very active in working with Region 1 and 2 in the development of their riparian policy to see what portions of their work would be useful here.
Thanks, Larry. Chris Adair, Water Board staff. I just wanted to say again that we are planning a workshop in July. We're hoping to, as a team, sit down with you and talk about how we go about adopting stormwater management plans and get some feedback from you in a situation where we're not, where you're not making a decision. And I think that would be a helpful thing. We, as staff, put together an outline that reiterates Mr. Briggs' points that of what we're going to talk about. I also wanted to mention that Ryan's noticeably absent today, and he's going to take the lead on this. He's off on paternity leave. His wife just had a baby girl, and he'll be back next week. Any questions?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Chris just handed me an outline for the July workshop, and the intent here is to provide this to the board, and if you have any questions about it or if you want us to cover additional things that are not on here, let us know, and we'll include it in the
workshop. Do you want to
workshop.
Put it on the projector? Oh, you're passing it around.
We're passing it out.
Okay.
So and you can communicate with us by email or telephone.
Is this a workshop before the board?
That's what I was asking.
Or is this a separate workshop?
It's a workshop for the board.
Agendized
July meeting.
For the board. For
it'll
the
be
board
agendized.
Meeting.
And the idea is that it's a general workshop, so it's a general discussion about the stormwater management program and adopting stormwater management plans, and you will not have a plan in front of you to consider or adopt. So
gee, what a change.
Yeah. So we can talk more freely about the process.
Will you... Would it be appropriate to unpack MEP a little bit in this particular workshop? Because we had had some back and forth on that, and it'd be nice to discuss MEP not in the context of a particular plan.
Everyone's nodding.
Yeah.
So yes,
okay.
We can do that.
All right. Again, press states the obvious.
That's the end of all of our presentations. I hope that this gave you some overview on what we have available and also gave you some more information about all the things that staff is doing now. We have some great staff who's working on this, and obviously they're very excited about it, and they've been working really hard on it, and I look forward to further discussions at board meetings.
Okay. Lori, what is your sense, when I look at these different tools, if you want to call it that, legal tools. I think Dr. Press kind of touched on the fact that some of them are more short-term than others. Construction permits last the life of the project. And I think the certifications also, the 401s.
They're for the life of the project, but the post-construction requirements require the LID features to be implemented and to be maintained.
Okay.
So in that sense, they're long-term.
Okay.
But there's not ongoing enforcement.
Okay. So we're left with basin planning or the swamps, really, mm-hmm. is kind of the long-term tool that gets left in place. And do you have a sense for which one is a better tool to do or to institutionalize LID?
Not without more input from staff and the report back from Jennifer on what she's found on what other regions are doing and what other states are doing. They're both very good tools, and I don't think that they're I know they're not mutually exclusive. They they have drawbacks. So once staff has a recommendation about where to go, it will be more obvious what's the best way to get there.
Okay. Well, we look forward to the board being informed as to staff's progress, so we can encourage staff to move towards this, because I think, as Gary has pointed out, it really is kind of a very key water quality component that needs to be put into place so that when the inevitable happens, we're taking care of it automatically. So I think it's kind of maybe the legacy we can try to leave at this point in time. Any board comments or questions? Nothing, huh? All right. Yes. I do. Kira Rudman, formerly Kira Schmidt, Santa Barbara Channel Keeper.
Good morning, Chair, board members. My name is Kira Rudman now, yes, the Executive Director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. Since the mission of my organization is to protect and restore water quality in the Santa Barbara Channel and its watersheds, we're, of course, very concerned about urban runoff, and we're also very excited about low-impact development. As such, we would strongly support the widespread implementation of LID strategies. We think it's the wave of the future. It has so many benefits, and it just makes sense. While there are some developers and dischargers and municipalities that are forward-thinking and that may integrate LID into their projects and facilities on their own without any requirements imposed on them to do so, there are many who won't. For example, Santa Barbara County. Given the political landscape of the Board of Supervisors, the county is clearly not going to do anything beyond the bare minimum that's absolutely required of them, despite the many water quality impairments that they have. Therefore, Channel Keeper supports an effort by the Regional Board to promote and require LID throughout the region. I'd like to emphasize the importance of doing so not only for new development, but also for retrofits in areas that are already built out, like Santa Barbara. I'm not exactly sure how best to do this yet, but the basin plan amendment angle is an interesting one, such as mandating a no net increase in flow or velocity. 401 water quality certifications should also include LID requirements. A region-wide MS4 permit is an interesting idea, but we'd be concerned that the outcome could be a lowest common denominator. As you know, Channel Keeper believes that some of the municipal stormwater management programs that have been approved by this board are less than adequate, so we'd be very concerned about that. We'd like to echo Mr. Wolf's sentiment that long-term maintenance of LID techniques and facilities is critical, and that requirements for enforcing this should be included in anything that the regional board decides to go forward with. Being a keeper and given the severity of the stormwater pollution problem and the difficulties of getting our hands around it, Channel Keeper prefers the means that give the regional board the most powerful and effective carrots as well as sticks to institutionalize LID as quickly as possible. We're open to ideas and look forward to working with the board on this important issue. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. Any board questions? Okay.
I had one.
Mr. Shawcross.
Maybe for Jennifer, I don't know, maybe Lori knows this. Is the state legislature doing anything in this area?
I haven't seen anything.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. In this workshop, Chris, is mainly just focusing on swamps and not so much LID. That's totally separate.
Yes, in July.
Yeah, right.
We're going to focus on swamps.
Okay.
And then we'll be back to you perhaps in September and talk a little more about our progress on LID.
Okay.
And there will be some, actually, there will be some information that will come out in the meantime, too, a report to you, I think, in June. That'll just some of the things that we've done, some of the things that are going on, you'll get a little status report, I think.
Good. Okay. Well, to the rest of the board, as you review this list, if there's anything you feel that staff needs to include in this overview they're going to give us, please let Roger know so that they can start to work towards that end.
Yeah, the sooner the better.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Mr.
Well,
Jackson.
I don't have a question, but I was just thinking as we progress with this project and plan and we start to implement it, maybe we can submit it to somebody in the legislation to carry a bill to enforce this.
The LID concept?
Yeah. But I think we're on the right track, but there's a lot of development to...
Right.
Us to develop, not developers develop, but us to develop the project before we get that far, that we can make sure that hopefully that if we do that, that it'll pass the legislation. Yeah.
You know, there was the State Board actually, I think, sponsored a workshop called the Awani Workshop, where it took place at the Awani Hotel in Yosemite, and it came out with the Awani Plan. And it's a couple of years old, right, at this point, but it fully articulates the principles and concepts of LID in a very eloquent, comprehensive way. And that in and of itself would be, you know, appropriate, I think, to kind of roll into something that might be legislated.
Yeah, they're called the Awani Principles.
Principles.
And they're available on the website of the Local Government Commission. And they've been used as an organizing principle for a series of discussions thereafter. The local government commission just finished holding two workshops. One was in the Bay Area, and I'm not quite sure where the other one was, but I think a Southern California location, under a grant under our 9-point source program on this topic. And they were, you know, talking with local government representatives about the Ahwahnee principles, the value of local government endorsing those principles, and some of the details about what it means to not just endorse the principles, but what it means for your general plan. You know, how at a local planning level you implement those principles. I was not at either of the workshops, unfortunately, but there were some workshops just held, and I'm sure someone from the local government commission would be happy to come down and talk to you if you could, you know, if you wanted to invite them and arrange that at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Since I sort of brought the legislature up, I just want to say that since having worked in the legislature, I wouldn't want to go to the legislature too early. I think we need to build a track record because what I think the danger is, if you go too early without a good track record, the danger is you're going to wind up with a watered-down, lowest-denominator-type bill that we might have to live with then.
Right.
So I think we need to sort of fly under the radar right now and sort of implement some of these things, and just so we can show people that they're cost-effective, they raise property values, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, eventually it would be a good idea.
That makes sense.
And speaking of flying under the radar for proposed legislation, we have to fly under the radar as far as how we work with the state board, Cal EPA, and the administration to have a bill that's backed by the administration. But there are methods for doing that.
When the state board does a renewal of a statewide permit, does staff normally get involved in that process? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess whatever you have developed, you know, up to that point in time when the statewide swamp is going to be renewed, you know, I think we would encourage you to try to get some input into that at that point in time. Okay, thank you very much. That was a good presentation.
Just a reminder then, you might need to digest this a little bit more after you go back home, so please do send me an email, give me a call. If you have other ideas, there were actually some other things I mentioned in my introduction that we intend to cover. So, any additional ideas, we'd like to be prepared to discuss those with you.
Okay. Why don't we move on then